From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen. Coming up, Barack Obama has been in talks with Hillary Clinton to become his Secretary of State. We'll hear what people in Europe, China, and the Middle East think of that choice in just a few moments. But first, we go to Mumbai, India, where at least 150 people have been killed and hundreds more injured in coordinated terrorist attacks throughout the city. Among those killed, Americans Alan Scher and his 13-year-old daughter, also Rabbi Gavriel Noach Holzberg and his wife, Rivka, who ran the Chabad house in Mumbai. Today, a team of FBI agents were ordered to fly to India to investigate the attacks. Earlier, we spoke with reporter Anuj Chopra in Mumbai. We asked him to comment on what was going on at that time at the Chabad house.
This morning, there were paramilitary forces, commandos who got off a helicopter on the roof of this Jewish center to try and seize control of it. They've been engaged in this action all this morning. I was speaking to someone who owns an apartment in a building in that neighborhood who can see right inside that building, right through that building. And she told me that the commandos had seized control of the fourth and the third floor, and the terrorists and the hostages were confined to the second floor. I heard news reports that they had seized control of the entire Jewish center this evening. But while I was there, I heard gunshots, which sort of left doubts in my mind that things aren't entirely under control.
There are also Indian forces present at the Taj Mahal Hotel, a luxury hotel. Do we know about how things are going there?
I'm actually standing right in front of the Taj Mahal Hotel as I speak with you. This has been going on for the last 3 days. We hear these deafening grenade explosions somewhere inside the hotel, and also roars of gunfire breaking at irregular intervals. This evening I saw paramilitary forces in front of the hotel, and they were up to something. They were trying to get in, try and seize control, but it's obviously not over yet. I was interviewing a bomb defusing expert who said it's a little difficult to seize control of this huge structure because of the sheer size and the architecture. You know, you get inside and there are mirrors almost everywhere. There are lots of mirrors. And anyone who tries climbing upstairs sort of implicitly gives a warning to the guy on the top, sort of knows that someone is trying to approach him. And it just makes that job very difficult. Inside, we also understand that these hostages that they've taken are being used as human shields, which I guess just makes the job more time-consuming. It's been 3 days, and India still... The authorities here are still struggling with seizing back control of this hotel, this iconic hotel in Mumbai.
Anuj, briefly, is there any news on who might be responsible for these attacks?
We've heard the name of this unknown jihadi group called the Deccan Mujahideen, and this is certainly the first time I've heard of this name. India is more familiar with another jihadi group called the Indian Mujahideen, which is doing the rounds in recent months, after several cities were bombed. But there are terror experts who say that you shouldn't take names seriously. These are just disguises of radical Islamic groups that are based in Islamabad, that are based in Pakistan. I guess it's considering the fact that this is still unfolding, it's so, sort of shocking that these terrorists entered this iconic building. The fact that they've been going on for 3 days. I remember the Indian Parliament was attacked in 2001, and the Indian authorities managed to gun them down in a matter of a few minutes. But this is just taking forever, it seems.
Anuj Chopra is a freelance journalist in Mumbai, India. Thank you. Terrorism in India, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, genocide in Darfur. These are the sorts of issues that Senator Hillary Clinton will face should she take on the role of Secretary of State in the Obama administration. To get a sense of how the world feels about the prospect of Mrs. Clinton as Secretary of State, we called up several journalists around the world. We begin in Brussels with David Rennie. He's the European Union correspondent for The Economist. He said Europeans have mixed feelings.
Well, I think it has to cut both ways. There is tremendous excitement about President Obama and the idea that he's new and represents this dramatic change. So you could say people would be disappointed to see something that is from the past, and also the fact that Senator Clinton did support the Iraq War, which was the big central bust-up between the Bush administration and Europe. On the other hand, Europe, in common with every other foreign bloc that has to do with America, is at the most basic level flattered that a big star seems to be getting the job of dealing with foreigners. It would be insulting and worrying if someone rather obscure or perhaps not that important was given this job. But this sends a signal that foreigners are going to count for this new administration.
You mentioned her support of the war in Iraq. There has been some tension between Europe and the U.S. over that issue. So how do you think Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State would help repair some of that tension?
Well, that is the kind of the big million-dollar question for everyone, I guess, and probably in America too, is will this be a Hillary Clinton foreign policy, or will she sincerely and accurately represent the foreign policy of her new president? Clearly, Europeans are slightly closer to some of the positions on certainly the Iraq war, but also on the need to have dialogue with Iran. When President Obama said that during the campaign, that resonated very well in Europe. So that's the kind of policy position that will go across. Well, I'm inclined to think that the actual person who holds the job as Secretary of State doesn't at the end affect the macro view that Europeans would have of American foreign policy. And the proof of that, in a way, is Colin Powell was Europe's kind of Secretary of State. He was our kind of guy. But at the end of the day, he had to deliver the foreign policy of the Bush administration, and the first-term Bush administration was as unpopular as it got.
One of the other issues she will likely have to deal with is Russia, and the U.S.'s relationship with Russia has grown a bit tense, especially after the skirmish with Georgia. What advice would you give her to deal with Russia?
Well, don't expect unity from the European Union. The name does not say what it says on the tin. We are not united on Russia. There are two huge schools of thought as to whether we should engage or whether should we be pretty skeptical of Russia and think of it as a friend or a fairly aggressive and worrying neighbor. And she will be disappointed if she expects a common view from Europe.
David Rennie of The Economist, thank you so much.
Thank you.
To China now. Hillary Clinton has condemned China's human rights record, and she's warned about American economic dependence on that country. So what do the Chinese have to say about Mrs. Clinton? Joining us now is Mark Monnier. He's Beijing bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome to the program, and tell us a bit about what you've been hearing about how the Chinese people feel about Clinton's probable appointment.
Generally, I think they're positive on the prospect of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, with a couple of the caveats that you mentioned. One of the things I think in this part of the world, and particularly in China, is that they put a lot of stock in long-term relationships and continuity and someone they know. And the Clintons have been on the scene for quite some time. They liked Bill. He's multilateral. He was generally quite respectful of the Chinese and seen as a moderate relative to the Bush administration.
You mentioned Bill Clinton. When he was in office, he was quite the ally to China, and he paved the way for its entry into the World Trade Organization. Do you think that that puts Hillary Clinton in a bit of a bind in terms of getting tough?
I think the Chinese sort of see them as a little bit of a pair, that it's a brand, if you will, the Clinton brand. But there is concern, which I think you mentioned at the top, about some of the things she said on human rights during the campaign. She criticized President Bush for not being strong. She called on him to boycott the Olympics opening ceremony, which is very, very important, huge face for the Chinese over the Tibet issue. I think it is very much a mixed picture.
And how might Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State affect how the Chinese feel about a President Barack Obama?
I detect a little bit of concern that they are wondering just how close she would be to Barack Obama, whether there would be tensions there, and how that might play out in the foreign policy arena.
Mark Monnier is the Beijing bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the past, Hillary Clinton has stressed the need for peace in the Middle East. Here now with his thoughts on the role she might play in achieving that goal is Rami Khoury. He's editor-at-large of the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Khoury. One Arab diplomat summed up Mrs. Clinton this way. She's not incredibly popular in the Arab world, but she is a known quantity. How do you think she might fare as Secretary of State when it comes to affairs in the Middle East?
People have mixed feelings about her personally for various reasons. Her background in the Senate. Her very, very pro-Israeli positions have generated a lot of criticism, but people understand in New York that's the way things are, and in Washington that's the way things are. They also remember her speaking, you know, about the Palestinians positively years ago when she was the wife of the president and did not have an official position and was not subjected to electoral pressures. So people have mixed feelings about her, but they understand that the Secretary of State doesn't make policy. The government makes policy. So we will judge her, I think, pretty much by the policies that she represents. And her tone, her emphasis in her talk, her body language will make a difference, perhaps, and that remains to be seen.
An editorial in your newspaper recently noted that given all of the other situations going on in the world that the U.S. has to deal with, that it might be difficult to bring attention to your region of the world. So how do you think you can make the Middle East one of the future Secretary of State's priorities?
I think by pushing the United States to think logically and sensibly and not ideologically, to look at the Middle East in a cold, calculated, rational way, to understand the real dangers that emanate from this region continuing on its trend of conflict and tension and stress, and looking at the real problems in the Arab-Israeli issue, in Iran, in internal Arab situations, really identifying the core issues and addressing them rather than letting Middle East policy be driven by special interest groups or lobbies or foreign influence.
You mentioned earlier that her gestures, her tone of voice, everything will be watched. What do you think people are looking for?
I think people are looking for a sense that the United States is committed to the equal and simultaneous rights of the Israeli and Arab-Palestinian people, that no side has greater rights than the other side. If that can come through, that tone can come through, I think that'll be a huge factor for positioning the U.S. again in a way that it can be a credible mediator.
Rami Khoury is the editor-at-large for the Daily Star newspaper in Lebanon. Thank you, Mr. Khoury.
Thanks for having me.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen. In St. Louis, teenage peer pressure has taken a violent turn. Street gangs are recruiting adolescents and kids, some as young as elementary schoolers. From member station KWMU, Adam Allington reports.
In a windowless interior office at St. Louis Metropolitan Police Headquarters, Detective Alfonso Hayes' desk is littered with maps, printouts of MySpace profiles, and various photos. Over his shoulder, a pegboard is crowded with Polaroids.
On this board are the photographs of gang members who were shot and killed in the city of St. Louis. It's almost completely covered.
Hayes says the most recent photo went up less than a week ago.
2600 block of Madison, rolling 60 Crips. Mostly all these guys are dead or in jail. All of these guys.
On the surface, the story of gang violence in St. Louis seems like a version of the L.A. gang wars of the 1980s and 90s. Bloods versus Crips, shooting it out for drug turf. In reality, it's much more random, with murders and shootings happening over standard teenage drama, things like jealous boyfriends or sports rivalries.
What would you say is the average age for a kid in a gang in St. Louis?
Probably 14. You enter a stage of your life where fitting in with your friends is of the utmost importance. They're highly unpredictable. And that's a scary thing.
There are just so many more gangs than there used to be, about 80 in St. Louis, with beefs often pitting block against block.
From Carter all the way to Lee, that's our turf.
A guy who calls himself Woody and his buddy Fats are part of a Crip gang set in North St. Louis.
Who are the guys next to you?
Margarita. From Lee to Natural Bridge is they turf.
Do you guys get along?
Nah, we don't get along with them. It's been an on and off thing. One minute they cool, then next minute they got hard, they bulk up like they can't be touched.
Woody's only 16 and still in school. Like most teenagers, he wants to fit in, except in this case, fitting in is a dangerous prospect.
You want to hear your name too. You want to be popular. It's like a popular thing. I'm tired of hearing Fast name all the time. Why my name? All right, well, give me the gun. I go shoot at him. That's what it is. It's popularity. You're trying to take out the big shots.
St. Louis police began noticing the trend several years ago when they started assigning officers to basketball games and pep rallies.
They're not allowed to click up what we call clicking up coming numbers and showing colors. We got zero tolerance for them attending activities as a gang.
Lieutenant Ronnie Robinson is a watch commander in the Metro Police Department. He says sometimes the only way to make headway with violent kids is to approach them on their level.
If I say, hey, you leave this kid alone right here, he don't want to be part of this gang no more. He belongs to us now. He belongs to the police department. If anybody touches him on the way to school or on the way to the store or approaches him in a negative way and it comes back that you involved or your gang involved, you're going to have a lot of problems with the St. Louis City Police Department.
The police are kind of like another gang.
Well, we're the most organized gang in the city of St. Louis. We have to be.
But a boots-on-the-ground police presence isn't solving the problems of crumbling neighborhoods, no jobs, and bad schools. Carl Luss is a former member of the Blood Street Gang. Sometimes he says the only way to keep the heat on or buy food is to join a gang.
I see a lot of people who struggle, who got jobs. They got to wait 2 weeks to get a $250, $300 check. That's something I can't wait on. You know, I'm used to fast money.
Luss has been arrested 3 times and faces 15 years if he gets caught again. He's enrolled in a program called Community Partnership Restoration, or Gang CPR, which tries to help convicted gangbangers break from their old neighborhoods.
My mom and them always tell me I'm scared to change, and I'm kind of starting to believe it. It ain't got nothing to do with nobody calling me soft or no nerd or nothing. It's just I'm so wrapped up in the lifestyle that I am in.
The Gang CPR program is one of the success stories in a struggle with few reasons to celebrate. Several weeks ago, an off-duty firefighter was shot by a gang member who mistook him for a police officer. The 154th homicide so far this year, over 30 more than this time last year. For NPR News, I'm Adam Allington in St. Louis.
This Thanksgiving week, we've been offering a little respite from all the glum financial news. We've been checking in with people who are doing all right, despite the bleak economy. This day, after the big turkey feast, we hear from an industry almost guaranteed a boom in business. We're talking about plumbing. Kevin Shaw runs Kevin Shaw Plumbing here in Southern California. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you.
So I have heard that the day after Thanksgiving, plumbing companies can do as much as 50% more in business. Why is that? What's going on the day after?
We see a big increase in the number of people that call us with a plugged up kitchen sink, or maybe a toilet is plugged up. Those are the two big plumbing calls that we'll get today.
And so are you expecting a lot more calls today? What's it been like so far?
It's been busy. It's definitely your traditional day after Thanksgiving where the phone starts ringing earlier in the day, and it just keeps on ringing. We're going to have a lot of people that are going to have a lot of company over from yesterday, and a lot of people trying to be helpful in the kitchen, and they're going to put those potato peels down the drain and carrot peels and other stuff that normally wouldn't go down the kitchen sink drain.
Kevin, I've been one of those people before. A few years back, I actually had a busted kitchen sink on Thanksgiving Day, and I couldn't find anyone open that day. And by the next day, I was in a panic. Do you get the panicked calls the day after?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, people are just, they're going to find that a lot of the plumbers have not opened, or maybe the regular plumber that they've called always is not going to answer their phone or, you know, say that they'll get right back to them. They get a voice, machine or something.
Because you can capitalize on people's need the day after Thanksgiving, do you charge any more today?
No, we don't. It's just another work day.
Can you think back to last year, the day after Thanksgiving? What was the most interesting call you received?
We had a customer call in Pasadena. Their kitchen sink drain was just completely plugged up. One of the guys was out there, and he couldn't get it unstopped. So he called me, and I came over. And no matter what we did, we would run the cable, it would seem to want to clear, and then it would stop up again. And we ended up having to go underneath the house and cut a section of the drain line out. And it was incredible. The whole drain was just completely packed between turkey grease and potato peels. It was like mush in the drain, and it just kept collapsing. And it was like a big sponge where the water would hit, and it would just expand.
Kevin, I imagine doing what you do, you can't have much of an appetite for leftovers on a day like today.
No, I'll probably be eating a hamburger or something today.
Well, I wish you a very good day, and thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Absolutely. Grace, have a great time.
You too. That's plumber Kevin Shaw. This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen. Later in the program, across the nation, they are slowly disappearing. What has become of the big blue mailboxes? First, though, it has been said that the attacks in Mumbai, at least symbolically, are the first real test of the Obama presidency. The president-elect issued a statement strongly condemning the attacks. Here to shed light on the unwritten rules that apply to presidents-elect is NPR news analyst Juan Williams. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Alex.
So Barack Obama doesn't actually take office for about 2 more months, so is it fair to call Mumbai a test for him?
Well, obviously, the tremendous economic crisis the country is going through is something that threatens to derail Obama's train before it leaves the station in terms of his inauguration on January 20th. But, Alex, when you think about the terrorist attack in Mumbai, what you have is a situation where this has been identified by the American public as a potential point of weakness. The Bush administration has also said that when it comes to vulnerability, there's a pattern with terrorists identifying moments of political transition as prime for attacks. So in so many ways, this is a test for the president-elect. And what we've seen so far is the president-elect being quite aware of it. He had a briefing from Secretary of State Rice on Thanksgiving Day over the phone on the situation. They've established a team of people from the Obama transition team to interact with the State Department Operations Center. So right now, Barack Obama, I think, is finding himself, having to be a quick study, but a quick study with so much on the line, literally the safety of the world.
And Juan, what is the protocol here for how a president-elect handles a situation like this while there is still a current president in office?
Well, this is just such a unique situation, Alex. We've never had a transition like this before. Obviously, President-elect Obama is naming people before December to his cabinet. And when it comes to the whole notion of dealing with terrorists, the Bush administration for some time has been bragging that they want this to be a very smooth transition. And so they have put in place a transition clearance team that eased the clearances of all the Obama transition people so they could get information necessary to really hit the ground running in January.
Juan, it's Thanksgiving week, time for lots of talking. What's your best conversation this week?
Well, I think it's a conversation. This is a funny one, Alex. This started with Nancy Pelosi announcing, like this was last week, we're not using the word stimulus anymore around here. That the idea that stimulus reminds people of shock therapy, Alex.
Wow.
And there's been some talk about the idea that when you talk about a bailout, it suggests someone feverishly throwing water out of a boat that's sinking. And therefore, not a good image. And that if you want to get political support in place for, a stimulus package. So I'll have to say a economic recovery program, Alex. That's the official Democratic language now. An economic recovery program. We have to talk about it in those terms as a recovery program, as opposed to a bailout or a stimulus. So watch your language, Alex. Everybody's listening to what you have to say.
Duly noted. NPR News analyst Juan Williams, thank you so much, Juan.
You're welcome, Alex. Have a fine weekend.
You too. As we begin the holiday season, we decided this year we want to give our listeners a gift. And we realize there's really only one thing we have to give.
Now I can't give you anything but
radio.
Oh, baby, oh. That's the only thing I have plenty of.
Radio.
Baby.
Yes, we want to make some radio just for you. So if you have an idea, someone you think we should interview, or a story you'd like to hear, let us know. You can leave your suggestions at our blog. It's npr.org/daydreaming. We'll pick a few favorites, and we'll do our very best to put them on the radio.
I can't give you anything but
radio.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. Lately, there has been a lot of talk that what this country is going through now is the worst economic crisis since the 30s. But that's an American perspective. Other countries have gone through crises like this one a lot more recently. NPR's Martin Costi used to be our reporter in South America, and in this reporter's notebook, he says, this is all beginning to feel a little too familiar.
The deja vu hits me in the men's department. The store is practically empty. I'm at the cash register.
Hi. Here you go. Take these.
I'm stocking up on sports coats. They're already pretty cheap last week, and now they're another 50% off. Also, I brought a coupon.
Okay. Yeah, it's this thing here.
And it's right here, as I'm digging for that coupon. This is where the deja vu sets in. The last time I bought sports coats like this, I was covering the financial crisis in Argentina. That was 2002. The deals in Buenos Aires were fantastic. $50 for a coat, $30 for handmade leather shoes, and the wine, amazing Malbecs for $6 a bottle. Argentina had been expensive in the 1990s, but the country's prosperity was propped up by foreign loans, and that house of cards came down hard in 2001. The government flailed its way through a series of rescue packages, then froze everybody's bank accounts. For us, the foreign reporters, it was a strange time. We spent the day covering human misery, a middle class forced back down into poverty, lost pensions, whole families out collecting cans, barter markets cropping up in the middle of the city. Then we'd do our stories, upload them by midnight, and it was off to Café Dada for a filet mignon. $7. We knew how it looked, like we'd come to loot the place. I tried to play down my purchasing power, at least around my Argentine colleagues. People like Susana, a local TV reporter I hired as a guide on one of my first visits. Her own situation was pretty typical. The TV station hadn't paid anybody in months, but she kept showing up for work just to hold on to her job. We got along well, and after a while I loosened up. I mentioned a side trip that my wife and I were planning to Patagonia. Go see the sights. How could we not, I said, with airfare so laughably cheap. Right away I apologized. But even at the moment I had to ask myself, what exactly was I apologizing for? Here in the men's department, 6 years later, I'm still wondering. I'm also wondering if I can really afford all these sports coats. Now that America is having its own economic meltdown. This time around, I don't have the privilege of playing the detached foreign reporter. This time, it's my home we're talking about. The sales clerk gets my attention.
Sorry, let's try.
Sorry?
Yeah, this scanner.
Oh, the coupon is not working?
No, I was scanning you.
He's having trouble scanning in my coupon for the extra 10% off. Don't bother, I tell him. I've probably had enough discounts. As it is. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Cohen. Today is the National Day of Listening. It's a new post-holiday tradition where we invite you to interview someone you know. All week here at NPR, we've been sharing some of our chats with family and friends, and here's mine with my dad.
My name is Kip Cohen, and from 1968 to 1971, I was the managing director of Bill Graham's Fillmore East. Still famous concert hall in New York City where artists like Big Brother and the Holding Company and Jimi Hendrix and Crosby, Stills and Nash and The Who and others perform live.
You were a young adult in the 60s when I think there were maybe different notions about drugs and the role that they played in people's lives. What was that like?
Growing up in New York, right in the middle of all of that, both the cultural and the musical and the social phenomenon in the 60s, There was a very different attitude, and there was very little, if any, negative connotation to experimentation with drugs, and in fact, sort of a celebration of the process.
My dad experimented with drugs back then, as he did throughout most of his adult life at various jobs in the music industry, but it wasn't until he was in his 60s that he became seriously addicted to drugs, especially methamphetamine.
Well, it's a very sleazy drug, and one that I looked down on for many years, so it came as a surprise that I would even enjoy it. It lowered all inhibitions, and it produced a great sort of hedonistic sensation of being in touch with things, but by the same token, it was very isolating. It was not very social. It was a very ugly, controlling, dangerous experience.
What do you think caused your personal addiction to drugs?
Well, I can look back with some insight now that I've been through it and come out of it. I have built into the way I think and the way my brain works every aptitude for thinking and behaving like an addict. As I grew older, that infatuation and focus on addictive behavior became much greater. It was quite manageable for a very long time.
What happened when you got older?
Well, I think that I discovered things were changing. I wasn't exactly happy with all the change. A little boredom set in. And I think basically it all just got the best of me. And I sought the solace of trying to fulfill my addiction as opposed to keeping it under control, as though I could, and it's not something that can be controlled that easily.
You decided a little over 3 years ago, just before Father's Day, that you were going to get help. What made you make that decision?
Well, it's interesting that you would note that it was just before Father's Day. I have no memory of that whatsoever. It just, I had been joined at lunch by two old friends who I'd known for a long time, who didn't know each other, and both of whom were involved in their own long-term 12-step recovery. And following that lunch, both of them emailed me separately, saying basically the same thing. You're living a very dangerous life. You will die if you continue to do this. And by the way, you were really disgusting today. And I think the word disgusting really knocked me to my senses. The fact that it came from two separate people who wrote independent of one another. And that started a process of thinking by which I somehow figured that I probably should do something about this. I intervened on myself, in a sense, before things got completely out of control.
Was there anything that you learned about yourself in that process of recovery that surprised you?
Oh, there are many things, and they're all sort of related. The first of which was that it's much easier to be completely, transparently honest than it was to live the life of addiction in which honesty isn't really very helpful. And that waking up in the morning relieved of all that baggage was actually a very comfortable feeling.
You have been clean now for a couple of years. Do you ever worry that you might relapse?
Well, I don't worry about it, but I think about it often. In other words, what I say is I am in my fourth year of recovery. I am X number of days from the last time that I used. I am also about 35 minutes away from the next time that I might use. And the option to do so is there all the time. Do I obsess about it? No, I no longer obsess about it. Do I think about it? Yes. As soon as I'm perturbed or uncomfortable or bored or whatever, the addict mind says, oh, hello, I'm still here. What can we do to feel better quick? And I need to know what to do when that thought comes. And I do know what to do when that thought comes.
We're talking about this now, and it's for National Public Radio, and so that means that a lot of people might hear this. And I wonder how the experience for you of talking publicly about your addiction, how it feels.
Well, it's really interesting doing it this way because I'm aware of the potential audience, but on the other hand, I don't have to face them or see them or hear from them, which is what's lovely about radio, I suppose. I certainly thought very carefully about whether or not I wanted to do it.
What made you decide to do it, to say yes?
You know, two things. One is because you asked, and I don't mean someone asked, but because you asked. And the other was because I was relatively certain that I would learn something from it. And I have to concentrate on what we're doing, so I'm only learning sort of peripherally now, but I know by the time we're finished and as I walk out of here, I will have learned something valuable.
You said yes because I asked. What is it about me as your daughter?
Well, you said something when you first called that was very touching to me, because one of the things you do when you become a recovering addict and start to turn all this stuff around, you have to deal with all the wreckage and the baggage of all those years you left behind. And as you recall, and you and your brother and your mom, there was a lot of wreckage that I had to deal with. And I did that in accordance with everything that I've learned within 12-step recovery. And I'm comfortable with that. But I wonder frequently, what does Alex think about how I'm doing? And so, and it's not a question I feel I'm authorized to ask. So when you mention in the first inquiry that you wanted to do this, and I think what you said, something was, the feeling was that because you're very proud of what I've accomplished, that's an affirmation for me that I need to hear and I couldn't otherwise ask. And frankly, it, coming from you, it has great importance to me.
Thank you, Dad, for letting me talk to you and for being so honest. I appreciate it.
I love you and you're welcome.
My father, Kip Cohen, lives here in Southern California, where he spends much of his time sharing his story with other recovering addicts. If you'd like to hear other chats with NPR hosts or learn more about how you can do your own interview, go to our website. It's npr.org. Back now with Day to Day. The price of food is going up. Utilities aren't cheap either. Little surprise, then, that a growing number of Americans are trying an old-fashioned way to save on housing costs, sharing. As Vermont Public Radio's Nina Keck reports, many homeowners are deciding that giving up a little privacy is better than losing their house.
Heather Maas enjoys a cup of tea in her sunny kitchen. Like many Vermonters, she says rising heating fuel costs have hit hard.
When prices just skyrocketed this summer, I thought to myself, this is getting really way out of hand. I'm in this big old house. I'm by myself. I have plenty of room. It seemed to only make sense to include someone else in this picture.
Maas is a professional who works at home. She considered renting out her spare bedroom last year, but she felt uncomfortable.
Primarily because I had concerns about taking someone in that I knew nothing about.
But when she saw her retirement savings plummet and her annual fuel bill top $6,000, Maas called her local home share program. She could have just placed an ad in the local paper, but she liked that home share programs do thorough background and security checks and mediate any disputes. Typically, home share programs are nonprofits. Many were created to help the elderly. But that's changing. Kirby Dunn is executive director of Homeshare Vermont, the state's oldest homeshare organization.
In the past, people have been coming to us more who needed some help around the house. You know, I don't drive anymore, so I need somebody to help me, you know, get the groceries and take me to my appointments. But now the calls we're tending to get this year tending to be from people who are just really needing some financial assistance.
Annette Leahy Brennan of the St. Ambrose Housing Aid Center in Baltimore says she's seeing a similar shift. She tells the story of a newly married couple in their 20s who had just bought their first home.
They never expected that they would be interested in home sharing at this time in their life, but her husband was laid off. She is worried about what will happen as they try to hold on to the house and pay the mortgage and the bills. So she has decided to open her home to a possible home sharer.
At the Interfaith Housing Center outside Chicago, the number of homeowners with spare rooms for rent has tripled in the last 2 months. And organizers say they're getting calls from affluent suburbs they've never heard from before. An even larger number of people are setting up home share arrangements on their own. Craigslist, a popular online classified service, has seen home share postings jump 60% to over 360,000 last month. With the economic downturn expected to continue, proponents believe many more people could benefit, but they say privacy and pride issues remain major obstacles.
There's the issue of, well, how will I be perceived by my community if I do this sort of thing?
Back in Vermont, Heather Maas says most of her friends applaud her decision to home share, but she still worries about appearances.
Will my clients find out I'm doing this? What will they think of me? Pride is definitely a factor.
She smiles and admits she's much happier having a housemate. He's great at fixing things, and they respect each other's privacy. And she says that extra $400 a month makes all the difference. For NPR News, I'm Nina Keck.
'Tis soon the season that Americans send gifts and holiday cards through the mail, but not as many as they used to. The U.S. Postal Service is expected to deliver 8 billion fewer letters this year than it did in 2001. That decline, in part, is why those big blue mailboxes are disappearing from street corners across America. Stephanie Sanders of member station WFPL reports from Louisville, Kentucky.
You might call this the loneliest mailbox in Louisville, but you wouldn't think so. It's really close to a busy intersection, right next door to a real estate office and a financial consulting group. There's a YMCA right across the street and a school just around the corner. And there are tons of people around. They're dropping off their kids. They're getting ready for work. They're doing errands for the day. But none of them are stopping at this bright blue mailbox.
Tony Gorin is one person who does use this mailbox. He works next door at the real estate company and regularly drops off letters to his clients. He says the mailman always seems to have his hands full.
People stop there quite a bit. You know those little plastic bins they use? He's probably pulling out a good full one of those every time he stops once a day.
During the 6 hours I watched this mailbox, the only person who approached it was the mailman, Robert Carter.
This whole box doesn't have much of anything in it. This is one few. That might just cover the location.
Carter scrunches down, peers inside, and pulls out just two pieces of mail. In the 1960s and 70s, when these blue mailboxes were at their busiest, this collection box would average 200 pieces of mail a day. And this is why Louisville is doing away with one-third of its 900 mailboxes. Fewer people mailing letters means less money for the U.S. Postal Service, which lost $2.8 billion this year. David Walton with Louisville's Postal Service says in the declining economy, saving money is important.
You know, because of this decrease, and like many other private industries, we've been forced to become more efficient.
Walton says eliminating blue collection boxes means fewer miles postal workers have to drive, but officials have no idea how much money it might save. Other cities are also paring down their blue mailbox fleets. Last year, the post office eliminated almost 4,000 across the country. About 200,000 remain. National Postal Museum historian Nancy Pope says when blue mailboxes disappear, Americans lose part of their heritage.
You're taking something away that is part of their memory, part of their history, part of their community. Whether they use it on a regular basis or don't, when something is gone that used to be there, there is a pang there. There's a, you know, and the nostalgia that just hits in automatically.
Nostalgic or not, the Postal Service says in a time of economic distress and rapidly decreasing revenue, warm fuzzies can't trump the bottom line. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie Sanders in Louisville, Kentucky.